All right, time to continue on with the plant unit. And tonight's chapter is focusing on, as we have been mostly already, on flowering plants, otherwise known as what? Come on, you know. What are flowering plants called? Other than flowering plants. Angiosperms, right. The most successful plants, right? Which is why most plants that you could come up with, if you were to name some, would be angiosperms. Anyway, what we're focusing on within the angiosperms is reproduction. Mostly, and to a lesser extent, domestication of flowering plants. That's what the title of the chapter is. Speaking of reproduction, that's why angiosperms have flowers, right? Flowers are reproductive organs. And it's not really because the plant needs the flower as a reproductive structure, like directly involved in its reproduction, right? The flower is really an advertisement. It's a reproductive structure because it advertises something there that's an enticement for pollinators to come by, like this bee and many other insects, for instance, or birds or bats. There's all kinds of pollinators. But anyway, it draws a pollinate, some sort of animal by, gives it a reward for coming there, but in the process, the animal gets pollen on its body and then takes that pollen to a different plant, and that's how they end up successfully reproducing without actually getting together and mating like animals do. So there's nothing new. I'm sure you've seen bees visit flowers before. But this is actually a kind of an unusual situation, because the usual situation is that there is the bee is visiting the flower because the flower has nectar and it's trying to get that. That's not what's happening here. The bee is actually trying to mate with what it thinks is another bee. So it's not gathering nectar from this flower. It's being fooled into thinking this flower is another bee, and it's trying to mate with it. It's hard to say from a human perspective how much it looks like a bee to it. It might, to a certain extent. But I think the thing that really makes it work is that the plant emits a substance that makes it smell like a bee to the bee. And that's really what fools it. So this obviously is not going to work. This is not going to make more bees, because this is not a bee that it's trying to mate with. So eventually the bee will get frustrated, figure it out that it's nothing's happening, and go on to another plant. The plant has tricked it rather than rewarding it, in other words, but it still works exactly as if it had given it nectar, right? Because the reason that the flowers produce the nectar is to get the bees to come and get dusted with pollen. Well, that happens this way too, just without any reward. It's just an unusual example, but the major point here is that plants, since they are planted in the ground and can't move around like animals, need the cooperation of other organisms to help them with their reproduction, more so than other groups of organisms do. Well, let's go on to slide 2 and talk a little bit more about the flower. This, I think, if it's not identical to a slide in a different chapter, it's almost identical. We've looked at this before. Let's review, though, that there are 4 major parts to a flower. But I'm not asking you to list the parts, but what are those parts? What's another name for parts? There are 4 what in a flower, in a complete flower? What word did I use? The parts are stamens, carpels, sepals, and petals. But those are all examples of what? Whorls, right. 4 whorls in a complete flower, that is. Not all flowers are complete. This one happens to be an example of a complete flower. But a flower is only termed complete if it has all four of those whorls. There are incomplete flowers. It's incomplete if it's missing any one of the four. Not only are there four whorls in a complete flower, but overall there's two kinds of whorls in terms of their functions. So there are two vegetative, or sterile, I should say sterile, not vegetative, sterile whorls, which are the sepals and the petals. Sterile because they do not directly produce gametes. What are gametes? Right, sex cells are gametes. It's the unisex term. Sperm are gametes, eggs are gametes. And neither the petals nor the sepals produce those directly, therefore they are sterile whorls. The other two are fertile whorls, because they do directly produce gametes. But there's a male version and a female version. The stamens are the male parts. However many there are. By the way, obviously you already know that not all flowers look like this. There's a tremendous variety of size, shape, color, complexity. That's not only true for the most obvious part of the flower to us, usually, which is the petals, but also stamens and carpels. First of all, as I said before, they might or might not be there both, depending on whether it's a complete flower. But even if it's a complete flower, stamens don't look the same in all species. They don't all look like this, but typically they are long and slender. There's a stalk that ends in kind of a bulbous terminus, which is called the anther. The filament is the stalk, and then the anther is the bag-like or sac-like end of it. And the anther is bag-like because within that anther are where the pollen grains are produced. And pollen grains, as we'll look at in a little bit, contain male gametes. So stamens overall are male parts. There isn't necessarily six. There could be zero to any number. Carpels, on the other hand, are female parts, and it's not necessarily just one like it's shown here. Some plants have zero. Some plants have multiple carpels, but they're the female parts. And they're not all shaped like this, but typically they're kind of bowling pin shaped. This is a cutaway view, so you can see the interior of this bulbous base, which is called the ovary. An ovary is simply a place where eggs are made, just like in a woman's body. So when you cut the wall off the ovary to look inside, you can see ovules within. Well, ovule is just a word that simply means little egg. Ova, ovum, means egg. Ova is the plural of that. But the U-L-E ending means small eggs. Above the ovary is a slender style. And then that ends in a sticky stigma. The stigma is sticky, usually, because of resin. And why is it sticky? So that pollen, if it happens by, will stick to it easily. And the reason that's important is because if this flower is going to be fertilized, if reproduction is going to be successful, then pollen, which contains the male gametes, needs to land on the stigma so that a tunnel gets bored all the way down through the style into the ovary so that an egg can successfully reproduce a sperm can successfully fertilize one of the eggs that are in the ovary. If that doesn't happen, then there's no fertilization, which means that there's no reproduction that's successful. So, flowers are one of the three so-called Fs for angiosperms. You remember the other two Fs? Angiosperms produce flowers, unlike other plants. What else involving Fs? Fruit. Where does fruit come from? Flowers. If flowers are successfully fertilized, they develop into fruit. And then the third so-called F is double fertilization. The F is for fertilization, obviously, but it's double fertilization. Now, any sexual species involves fertilization by definition, right? That's the essence of sex. That's the defining event that makes something sexual, fertilization. So that's nothing special for angiosperms, but double fertilization is the special part of it. There are actually two different things that become fertilized, and we'll talk about that in a bit. First, let's go to 3 and look at a complete flower. The one shown here is really exactly the same picture we just looked at almost. The coloring's a little bit different. But anyway, it's a complete flower, so it has all four whorls. And what is illustrated in this slide is an explanation, hopefully, of what is called the ABC hypothesis to explain how the four whorls develop in a complete flower. So there are four whorls, but there are three genes involved, hence the ABC. They're the A gene, the B gene, and the C gene. Okay? Now, if you look at the archery target-looking thing at the top, notice the coloration refers to the or corresponds to the four whorls in the flower, and it's drawn as a target with concentric circles because really the whorls are concentric like that. The sepals are most outward because they are the covering before the bud opens up. All you see is the sepal. That's the outermost layer. And then inside that is the petals. Inside that are the carpels. The stamens. And inside, middlemost, are the carpels, as you see on the target. But also notice the ABC boxes on that target, representing genes. And notice how they overlap the zones of the target, which represent the whorls. What's being illustrated here is that the A gene governs both sepals and petals, the B, petals and stamens, and the C, stamens and carpels. And specifically, what has to happen is that the A gene has to be the only thing turned on in that part of the, you know, in the cells. You know, you have a collection of cells developing in a plant. That collection of cells needs to be develop into a flower. In cells in which only the A gene gets activated or turned on, that's going to develop into sepals. In cells in which both the A gene and the B gene get turned on, as you see in the target, those will develop into petals. In cells in which B and C are both turned on, that's going to become stamens. And in cells in which only C is activated, it's going to become carpels. All right? So that's how it normally happens. And what we have here listed as wild type, that wild type phrase simply means, it's used a lot in genetics, it simply means individuals that are most likely to actually be seen in a natural population. They have the wild type traits are the ones most commonly encountered. All right, so this wild type, you know, another use of the word wild type is comparative. It means wild type compared to ones that have mutated and are therefore genetically different from that wild type. So the wild type is so-called normal, and then you have different mutants here that have undergone mutation in one of those three genes, either A, B, or C, that control this whorl formation or whorl development. So everything goes normally, as we just described, in the wild type. Notice the mutant to the right of it is lacking A, meaning the A gene has undergone a mutation, and so now it either doesn't make a protein at all. Genes code for proteins, right? So it either doesn't make the protein at all, or it makes a non-functional protein. And either way, it's not working properly for the A gene. And therefore, it can't possibly lead to the formation of sepals, right? And in this mutant, you don't have any sepals. But A is also involved, along with B, in petal formation. So you can't have A and B both if you don't have A, therefore no petals either. B and C work normally, therefore the only thing this mutant can make are stamens and carpels. One example of an incomplete flower. Mutant lacking B, of course, can make sepals, which requires only A, and it can make carpels, which require only C, but not petals or stamens, both of which make B, and so on. The one on lacking C, though, I'm sure you understand the trend here already, but this one's interesting because the mutant lacking C can't make either stamens or carpels, both of which require C, right? So all it's going to make are sepals and petals, which are both sterile. So this mutant flower might attract something to it, but it's going to do the plant no good at all in terms of a reproductive organ, right? It's going to be impossible to get reproduction with a completely sterile flower. Also, well, I just wanted to go into that. So that's the ABC hypothesis. Let's go on to slide 4. And this is going to take a little bit of time to get through just this one slide. But don't think that the rest of it's going to go this slowly. Once we get through this slide, it'll go a lot quicker. There's a lot of detail in here, though, and I want to go through it kind of exhaustively. What we see here is the overall life cycle of a typical angiosperm, which, of course, plants are sexual, so it's really two life cycles in one, because there's the male version and there's the female version. We'll look at the female first, which is the smaller circle, starting at the top, starting at the flower picture. That's the same picture we've been looking at in all three slides now. This happens to be a species with a complete flower, so it has both male and female parts. Therefore, it at least has the possibility of self-fertilizing within the same individual. But anyway, whether it does or not, let's go through the female cycle. Notice, first of all, that there are two colors here overall, pinkish and bluish, representing different ploidies. Now, what is ploidy? I ask you this about every week.
The number of chromosomes?
Not really. That is a better definition for N. N is how many different types of chromosomes there are. Like, for instance, humans have 23 kinds of chromosomes, so N equals 23 in humans. Ploidy is not that. Ploidy is how many of each type a cell has. And so nearly all of the cells of your body or any animal's body have two of each type, right? One from the mother, one from the father. And therefore, that's a diploid cell. The only ones that aren't are the gametes that are produced. Our sperm are haploid cells. And eggs are haploid as well. So that's what ploidy is, how many of each kind of chromosome there are in a cell. Any sexual life cycle involves a haploid stage and a diploid stage. We went over this before, right? Like, animals spend their life as diploid individuals, multicellular, but then they have a unicellular haploid stage. The gametes don't get past unicellular stage. They either die as one cell, unsuccessful at reproduction, or if they are successful in reproduction, that means they come together in fertilization and that makes it diploid again. So there's never a multicellular diploid stage. Just the inverse of that for a typical fungus, right? Their body is haploid, multicellular, and then they, when they undergo fertilization and become a diploid zygote, that's one cell, but then it immediately undergoes meiosis to become haploid cells that will eventually develop into multicellular haploid adults. So the special thing about plants, remember, is what we call alternation of generations. And what makes it special is that both the haploid stage and the diploid stage in plants is multicellular. There's a multicellular version of any plant species that is haploid, and a multicellular version that is diploid. What do we call the diploid stage? The sporophyte generation, yes. Diploid here is represented by 2N in parentheses. That's the general symbol for diploid, because N is the haploid number. If there's only one of every chromosome, then you're going to have N of those total in a haploid cell. 2N, therefore, is diploid. So yes, the sporophyte generation is diploid. And in angiosperms, that's really the only version that you see. You know, you look at a tree or any given flowering plant, what you see as that organism is the diploid sporophyte. Kind of like our own bodies are diploid. You don't see the haploid version because it is actually inside the body of the sporophyte, if it's made at all, if it's successfully produced. Okay, so that's what the pink represents, diploidy, the sporophyte generation. And the flower, of course, is part of that sporophyte. It's a diploid structure. We're looking now at a close-up of the ovary, and more specifically, just one of however many ovules are in that ovary. We're just going to focus on one ovule. The ovule is made up of cells that make up a tissue called megasporangium. Now, mega means big, right? Sporangium simply means a tissue that produces spores. So megasporangium is tissue that produces comparatively bigger spores. Now, well, this is the female part of it. We're used to thinking about male and female for animals. Sometimes it's kind of hard for us to tell on certain animals, but usually you can tell what the male is and what the female is. But what about plants or any other sexual species? What is it that actually makes a female a female? How's the female defined in a species that's sexual? Well, that's kind of a word game, because we usually just call the egg, what the gamete that the female produces is usually called the egg, but that's because we just call the female gamete the egg. How do we determine what the female is to begin with? Well, what do you mean by gets fertilized? You say a sperm does not get fertilized, an egg does? Fertilization has to happen for it to be sex. But what's different about an egg fundamentally compared to a sperm when it comes to fertilization, and you're right here, you just didn't quite get to it, is that you don't really say that a sperm gets fertilized. You say an egg gets fertilized, because really all the sperm is doing is dropping off its DNA. It's really not much more than DNA and a packet of energy allowing it to get there, right? So when it injects its DNA, that doesn't add much to the cell that we called an egg just a moment ago. And that's because effectively no cytoplasm is donated by the male gamete. The egg is much bigger than the sperm. The female's gamete is much bigger. And that's how we define the female, the one that makes the bigger gamete. Why is it so much bigger? Because the bigger it is, the better a chance it has of surviving. The sperm is just a delivery device, pretty much, the male gamete. Doesn't add anything, really, except its own DNA. And therefore, when that happens, fertilization, you no longer have an egg, you now have a zygote. You had a haploid egg. Now when you add one of each of the kinds of chromosomes from the sperm, you have two of each kind of chromosome, and therefore it's a diploid structure called a zygote. But it's really the same size as the egg, because the only thing you've added is the DNA, right? That's why the female makes a big gamete, to make it live, to give it a chance of living. So these megasporangia are called that because the female makes the bigger spore, megaspores. And the tissue in which this happens is called megasporangium. Now, it's diploid, just like your germline cells are diploid. You have somatic cells and germline cells in your body. Almost all of your body is made up of somatic cells, which are diploid and stay diploid. They undergo only mitosis to produce more diploid cells. Germline cells are a tiny minority found only in your gonads, either testes or ovaries. And those are also diploid. But the difference is that germline cells undergo both mitosis and meiosis. And meiosis, remember, reduces the ploidy in half. Why does it undergo mitosis first? Mitosis just makes two of, when you started with one, it's the same ploidy, right? Why would a germline cell do that before undergoing meiosis? Well, if a cell enters meiosis and then meiosis is completed, where is that original cell? No longer exists, right? When a cell undergoes cell division, it's not like a mother giving birth to a child, the mother is still there. That cell that splits is no longer there. It's now two cells. In the case of meiosis, it becomes four cells. But the original cell is no longer there. So if you start with a tiny minority of cells called germline cells, and one by one they enter meiosis, you're going to deplete that population, right? Run out of them. So they first undergo mitosis. That makes two copies. One will stay behind and replace the one that's lost, and the other one goes through meiosis to become gametes, or spores. Okay? So that happens to one of the cells in this collection of cells called megasporangium. But it's 2N because it's diploid to begin with. All right? Meiosis, the box called, labeled meiosis, though, is what's happening in that one chosen cell of the megasporangium. And that ends up making four cells, because remember, meiosis from 181 involves two division events, right? Meiosis 1 splits the ploidy in half, and then meiosis 2 doesn't do anything to the ploidy, but it gets rid of that extra set of DNA, just like mitosis does. So you end up making four. Well, this is not done the same way in males and females, including in humans. In males, a germline cell that undergoes meiosis produces four equally viable or livable sperm. They're all ready to go. They're genetically different from each other because of the way meiosis works, but they're all equally able to survive. In a female, because she wants to make one big one, it happens unequally. So she doesn't make four equally small gametes. She makes one big one that she intends to survive and throws the other three away. Happens the same way in female humans. So the plant does that. That's not shown in this detail here. You kind of skip over that. But, oh no, actually you do kind of see this. Yeah, there are four cells here. Notice there are four cells and they're not equally sized. So these are four cells resulting from meiosis of that one chosen cell in megasporangium that undergoes meiosis. These three small ones will just disintegrate. They're useless. They'll be reused for their materials. But this big one is going to be the surviving megaspore. All right, the bigger spore. And that is already haploid because meiosis makes it haploid. Is everyone with me on all this? Okay. Now, let's go to this next picture. These three small ones from above that I said will be disintegrated, imagine those are already gone. They're not part of this next picture. That one megaspore, which is already haploid, started out as one cell, then undergoes three rounds of mitosis. Now, remember what mitosis is. Do you remember what it is? How do you define mitosis? It's only part of cell division. Mitosis is not cell division. Mitosis is division of the nucleus. If you're going to have complete cell division, you need mitosis and cytokinesis, which is division of the cytoplasm, right? Everything other than the nucleus. That's if they happen hand in hand. Well, here what you're having happen is three rounds of mitosis, but not three rounds of cytokinesis. If you start with one nucleus in that one megaspore, and you undergo three mitosis rounds, how many nuclei do you end up with? Three rounds of mitosis. How many? It's going to be a lot longer being on the slide if you don't give me answers. You got to look a little bit more alive.
Can you repeat the full question?
Yeah, if you undergo three rounds of mitosis, starting with one nucleus as a cell, how many nuclei do you end up with? No? Each mitosis round doubles it, right? So it's 2^3. 2, then 4, then 8. Right? Well, if you count these little purple nuclei here, you'll count 8. Those all came from this one nucleus in the one megaspore that's produced, the surviving megaspore. Okay? But you don't have three complete rounds of cytokinesis. You have almost three complete rounds, but you kind of have 2.5, in a sense. Cytokinesis happens along with mitosis for most of these nuclei, which is why most of these nuclei are in their own cells. Okay? There's 7 total cells here. 3 at the bottom, 3 at the top, and then one big one. The 3 in the bottom and the 3 in the top, those had cytokinesis happen at the same time as mitosis, just like you're used to. So they are all normal single nucleus cells. The big one in the middle, though, had 3 rounds of mitosis happen, but only 2 rounds of cytokinesis. So in that last round of mitosis, it split the nucleus into 2, without splitting the cytoplasm, and therefore it is one cell with 2 nuclei. Does that make sense? You see how that would happen if you didn't have that extra cytokinesis? Okay, so 7 cells, 8 nuclei. All right? The 3 small cells at the bottom, well, let's start at the top of the picture. The 3 small cells at the top, notice that those are labeled antipodal cells. Antipodal means at the opposite end from an opening. Well, there's a little opening on the bottom of this ovule. This is how the sperm get into it. And this is opposite the open end, so they're called antipodal cells. And that's really all I can tell you about them, because antipodal cells either do nothing or we haven't discovered what they do. They're just there to get rid of those extra nuclei, basically. Maybe that's what they're there for. They don't have any apparent function. Okay? The 3 on the bottom come in 2 types. The bottom middle one is the egg. And so that's a haploid cell. These are all haploid. except this middle cell is a special case. I'll talk about that in a second. But the egg is haploid, and then on either side of that is a synergid. So there's two synergids, one on each side of the egg. And they're called synergids because they are synergistic, meaning they help out in some way. Namely, they help out fertilization of the egg. What happens with the synergids is that they produce chemicals that are attractants. The chemicals attract the tunnel, the tube that forms a tunnel through the carpel that I was talking about earlier. That needs to be dug in the right direction. The chemicals produced by the synergids show the sperm which way to dig, or show the pollen cells which way to dig that tunnel so that it will be hopefully successful fertilization. And it makes sense that the synergids are right by the eggs because the egg is the target. That's where you really want that tunnel to end, right where the egg is. Okay, we've mentioned six of them. The seventh one, which is by far the biggest one, is called the central cell, also descriptive. It's in the middle of all those other six. But this is the one that's special because it has two nuclei. Now, each nucleus, if it were in its own cell, would be haploid. So there are two haploid nuclei. So technically, this central cell is a diploid cell, just in a non-conventional way. It's diploid with two nuclei, two haploid nuclei. So keep that in mind. That's called the central cell. Now let's go temporarily to the male, which is all the stuff in the male is going to be happening meanwhile, same time basically that the female stuff we just talked about is happening, but in different structure, of course. Now we're switching to the male whorl, or whorls, which are the stamens, and specifically the anthers. Remember, those are the bag-like places where the pollen are made. Well, the tissue that makes the smaller male version of the spores is called microsporangium, just by analogy with macrosporangium. Megasporangium. And the spores that are produced, the male version of the spores, are called microspores, the smaller spores. Unlike an ovule, which is going to produce one egg, if it's successful, an anther is going to produce millions of equally viable microspores, from the microsporangium. Microsporocytes are just another name for a microspore. The ocytes just means cells. Okay, so that microsporangium, just like megasporangium in the female part, is diploid, 2N. They undergo meiosis, though. And just like germline cells in male humans that undergo meiosis, all four of the resulting cells will be equally viable. You don't just save one big one. Well, there are millions of these things made, but we're just going to pay attention to that single one that's in the picture. They're labeled microspore. They're all going to be haploid, but this is just one of them. Okay, now, what happens next is the microspore is going to undergo mitosis and cytokinesis, but it's a special kind of cytokinesis. Normally, when you have mitosis and cytokinesis happen, it happens in such a way that what you end up with is two cells, two conventional cells, each with its own nucleus, right? But in this case, the mitosis splits the nucleus into two copies, and the cytokinesis happens in such a way that you have one cell ending up inside the other cell rather than two separate cells, just as the picture shows. And notice that these are labeled, they have their own names, a generative cell and a tube cell. All right? Generative meaning involved in producing the next generation, reproductive. Tube cell, obviously, is going to be involved in forming this tube I keep talking about. Okay, so they have different jobs. But the germ cell, the generative cell, is inside the tube cell. What's not shown in the picture is that the generative cell, the one that's inside the tube cell, then undergoes mitosis and cytokinesis again. And so what that results in are two cells called sperm cells, both of which are inside this tube cell. Now, why is it important for them to be inside the tube cell? Because the tube cell is going to dig the tube and form that tube. And if those sperm cells are already in that cell, they're going to be in the tube that results when it digs it. Okay? But even though you don't see the detail here, there's actually two sperm now inside. You see the sperm labeled here. You just don't see them. You don't see it labeled as mitosis. Two sperm inside the tube cell. So if, in the overwhelming majority of the cases, a pollen grain, which is what contains these two cells, generative cell and tube cell, that's a single pollen grain, and the coating that's outside of it. That's one pollen grain. And by the way, that one pollen grain with its two cells, that is the gametophyte generation for the male. Remember, there's a sporophyte generation. I said that's the only thing you really see. The gametophyte generation is just, in the male version, two cells big to start. Three cells if you count the extra sperm that gets produced. So, just barely multicellular, right? Remember, the special thing about alternation of generations is that both the haploid and diploid are multicellular, but in the case of angiosperms, that's just barely true still. They're almost unicellular, just two or three cells big for the male, and in the case of the female that we already went over, only seven cells make up this gametophyte. Once again, just barely multicellular. And you never see the gametophyte because it's inside an ovule, which is inside the carpel, inside the flower of the sporophyte. Okay, now back to the pollen grain. The overwhelming majority of those millions or billions of pollen grains that get produced just die because they land somewhere that's not a plant at all, or if it is a plant, it's not a plant of the correct type. Only the lucky ones will have a chance to build this, to dig this tunnel. And those are the ones that happen to get blown by or carried by a pollinating animal to the sticky stigma of the carpel of the right type of flower. And if that happens, that's actually what spurs on, by the way, the generative cell to go through the second round of mitosis to make the two sperm. And so that's already happened here. It's landed on the stigma. Now it's three cells big, two sperm within one tube cell, and the tube cell starts boring through that long style of the carpel. So that's a long way for one cell to dig through. This is a microscopic cell, and a carpel can be pretty long. Anyway, as it gets longer and longer making the tunnel, the sperm cells which are already in the tunnel because they're in the cell that's making the tunnel, just follow along. They dig all the way down until they reach one of the ovules, and now we get to the bottom picture. If all of that goes well, and by the way, they know how to dig, as I said earlier, they know which direction to dig in because they're being attracted by the molecules that are released by these synergids right by the egg. If all of that goes well, you can see it happening right here, and the tube reaches this opening of the ovule, which is right where the egg is, then the two sperm get released right there in the right position. And here's where it becomes double fertilization, that third F of the three Fs defining angiosperms. One sperm, just like in any sexual species, will fertilize the egg, which is right there at the end of the tunnel. And that's this fertilization that you're used to in any sexual species. Egg and sperm get together to form a diploid zygote. That zygote will be a one cell that is the beginning of the next sporophyte generation, diploid. Okay. The other sperm is released and fertilizes the central cell, that big one in the middle with two haploid nuclei already. Okay? So when the sperm adds one of each kind of chromosome, since it's haploid, to the central cell that already has two sets of chromosomes, right? Because it's double haploid in the sense, or diploid, then that's going to produce a cell that is triploid. Three of every chromosome. An unusual situation, right? But that's the second fertilization. The second sperm fertilizes the central cell, not to form a zygote and not a diploid structure. Instead, it forms a triploid cell that develops into what we call endosperm. Okay? 3N. So we see fertilization here. This really is both fertilization events. The fertilization of the egg by a sperm produces the diploid zygote. The fertilization by the other sperm of the central cell produces triploid endosperm, which then both of these undergo multiple rounds of mitosis to become multicellular. Just like you started out as a zygote, you underwent mitosis to become multicellular diploid. That's going to happen for the zygote in the sporophyte. It's going to produce the next generation of the sporophyte's body. But the endosperm, meanwhile, undergoes mitosis to become multicellular endosperm tissue, which is triploid. Now, what is that endosperm for? Well, it is there to support what is now an embryo. Remember, after it's a zygote, one cell stage, after it gets multicellular by mitosis, then we no longer call it a zygote, it's an embryo, just like in us. So that embryo, locked inside this structure, needs a source of food. It's not going to be able to feed itself like it will as an adult by photosynthesis. It's locked in this dark structure. So that endosperm is a source of nutrients for the growing sporophyte embryo. Now, this thing was called an ovule until just a moment ago. It's an ovule until and unless it gets fertilized successfully. If it gets fertilized successfully, and you not only have that zygote produced, which is successful fertilization, but then it undergoes mitosis to become an embryo, only then do you change the name from ovule to seed. So a seed is a former ovule that has already undergone successful fertilization. And it specifically contains an embryo of a sporophyte. So notice that this seed is still in the body of the original sporophyte, which is really two generations back. So this would be like a human carrying a grandchild in her body. Right? Sporophyte's body has the flower. Within that is a seed fertilized by the two gametophyte generations coming together within that body to produce an embryo of the next sporophyte, which is kind of like the grandchild of the original sporophyte. In a sense, really it happens the same way in us. It's just that our children are our gametes and our grandchildren are what we call our children. Right? It gets back to the same ploidy. But anyway, that's what a seed is. These things that are in the ovary are, before they're fertilized, are not seeds. They're potential seeds. They're called seeds when fertilization happens. And then the seed will remain as a seed with a living, just barely sometimes living, embryo inside it for many, many years in some cases. Depends on the species. Sometimes centuries before that seed will finally germinate into a new plant. usually because it needs some sort of signal, like a fire, for instance. Right? When a forest fire happens, that is a good signal to the seeds that are in that soil that this is your chance. Now there's no other adult trees above you that would hog the sunlight. It's your time to grow in full sunlight. So they're just barely alive because they have that finite source of food in them as a seed. But when they get the right signal, they will germinate. Now, why would plants have this double fertilization, which seems kind of overly complex? Why not just do it like we do? They could, but a major hypothesis for this is that it, in the long run, saves energy. Because if fertilization takes place successfully, that's when you have development of the flower into a fruit. And many fruits involve quite an investment of energy to produce. It's expensive to make the body of the fruit. Well, why you wouldn't want to bother to do that if you didn't have actual fertilized seeds in there, in that fruit. So the endosperm develops into most of the fruit, and the thinking is, and that's not going to happen unless the central cell gets fertilized as well. The thinking is, if the central cell gets fertilized, it's almost certain that the egg also got fertilized, because it's kind of a little bit harder for the central cell to get fertilized. So this way, if the central cell does not get fertilized, that means probably you didn't undergo fertilization of the egg either, and therefore it will shut down development of that fruit. It won't waste the energy of producing a fruit with no viable seeds in it. Okay, any questions on this very long slide? Does that all make sense? Okay. Let's go on to 5 and talk about pollination. Pollination just refers to pollen, which includes the male gametophyte, reaching the female parts of the correct types of flowers. And that can be a completely random event, meaning no organisms involved. We call such events that don't involve organisms abiotic. Biotic means involving organisms. Involving biological systems. Abiotic means not biotic. So there is abiotic pollination, primarily by wind, but also there is, and you could have actually water involved in pollination as well in certain cases, but usually it's wind. And wind, not exactly random, because there are patterns to winds, but the wind is not reliable on where it's going to end up, right? So it makes it much less likely that these pollen grains will get lucky enough. It just means even a greater majority of pollen will be lost if all you relied on is wind. Insects still are kind of random, because the insect has no idea what pollen is and it doesn't care anything about helping the plant out. It's there simply for a reward, right? But the reason it works so well and makes it kind of not random is that the insects learn what flowers have the rewards, and therefore they'll go get dusted by that kind of flower's pollen and go to another kind of that same flower. So it ensures that at least some of those pollen grains will go in exactly the right place and have a much greater chance of successfully boring down through the carpels to undergo fertilization. By the way, this picture of the dandelion, we're used to seeing it in normal white light, like this yellow one, and it looks like it's just one color to us, which wouldn't work so well because the pollen is produced centrally, and that's where the flower would like the insect to go, not just anywhere that it's yellow to us, but to the middle part. Well, if you look at it under ultraviolet light, which we can't see, but that insects can,
It looks more like a target.
With a bullseye that's drawing it right where it is.
So, I mean, this isn't exactly what a bee sees, I'm sure, but it's just more so than what we see.
So insects, by far, are the most prevalent animal pollinators or biotic pollinators. But they're not the only animal pollinators. There are also bats and birds that do so. We see bats pollinating around here when they visit cactus fruit, for instance, and we see a lot of hummingbirds as well. They're all doing the same job, but they just don't... In terms of numbers, it's mostly insects. Okay, 7. This isn't actually new information because we just went through this on the long slide, but it's a better view of this stuff. You see the tube cell burrowing down, including the two sperm cells, and they're being attracted by chemicals produced by these synergids. The goal is to get to this egg in the middle. You also see a good view of the central cell that has two haploid nuclei, so it's, in a sense, diploid already. When the two sperm arrive, one sperm fertilizes the egg to become the diploid zygote. The other sperm fertilizes the central cell to make triploid endosperm. And when all of this stuff becomes multicellular, then you officially have a seed, and contained in that seed is the now what we call the embryo of the next sporophyte generation. Slide 8. Well, let's focus not on the endosperm here, but just the zygote, which was the egg that got fertilized by that first sperm. Just like in us, it doesn't stay as a zygote very long, as a single cell. That single cell undergoes mitosis to become 2 cells, and then 4 cells, and so on. What you see here, though, is even at the very earliest stage, when it's just after one division, when it's only 2 cells big, this very early proembryo, as it's called, which really just means early embryo, already has some differentiation to it, meaning that the two cells already are different from each other. There's a terminal cell and a basal cell. The basal cell is going to become multicellular in itself and turn into eventually what's going to hold it, which is why it's basal, of the base, to the inside of the seed. The terminal cell, on the other hand, is going to continue to become a bigger and bigger embryo, which will eventually develop into seed leaves, either one or two of them, depending on whether it's a monocot or a eudicot. Remember, that's the definition of those two. The seed leaves, by the way, are cotyledons, don't really seem much like leaves, like conventional leaves. They kind of look like leaves because they're kind of flat and leaf-looking, but very tiny, of course. The big difference, of course, is that a conventional leaf is out in the open in the sunlight doing its job of collecting sunlight for photosynthesis. Well, that can't happen inside a completely dark seed. So why do we call them seed leaves? Well, even though they're in the dark, they're doing the same job as a conventional leaf. The job of a conventional leaf is to feed the rest of the plant, right? Via photosynthesis in the case of a normal leaf. But in the case of a cotyledon, its job is to feed the embryo, transfer nutrients to the rest of the embryo. And that's why we call them seed leaves. Now, that can happen in a couple different ways. I think I have a slide to show you the difference. Yeah, right here, slide 9. The species examples here don't really matter. It's just showing you 2 ways in which this can happen. In certain species, common garden bean is an example here, the cotyledons are not very big. They receive nutrients from the endosperm. Remember I said that endosperm is a source of nutrients. So if you open up a common garden bean, most of the stuff of that bean is endosperm. That's where most of the nutrients are. Those nutrients gradually, in this case, get transferred to the cotyledons, and then the cotyledons, like a middleman, deliver them to the rest of the embryo. So that's in certain species. In other species, like a castor bean, these structures are still involved, but you don't see much endosperm after a while, because the endosperm transfers it more or less all at once, those nutrients, to the cotyledons, which get really big and take up most of the space in the seed, and then deliver it to the embryo. So the same thing's happening. It's just slightly different ways in which it happens. On the bottom, for comparison of these top two eudicots, you have a typical monocot. What corn or maize is a monocot. You have the same thing happening here in terms of transfer of nutrients, except, of course, in a monocot, you only have one cotyledon. Ten. Well, back to this bean example, we can see that in a typical eudicot, there will be the beginning of what will be a mature root system eventually that erupts out of the seed. Remember, the seed, by definition, houses a developing embryo inside it that will become a mature plant eventually. But the seed, if it was one of the lucky seeds, it somehow got planted under the ground. An animal stepped on it or whatever. It's now in the soil, in the dark. And if it receives a cue, like water, then it's time to germinate. And it erupts a piece that is going to start the new root system. And kind of like a hook shape that comes out and then grows downward. All right? Remember that in a eudicot you have a taproot system. So this is the taproot, the very early taproot. That's going to be the biggest part. And then as it gets longer, this cane-shaped or hook-shaped is going to be dragged out of the soil. And the short end of the cane is where the seed still is, and that gets dragged out. And when it does, those cotyledons, which were inside the seed, get exposed, but notice that they wither away. The reason they wither away is that they're exhausted. They've depleted their energy stores. That energy went into building this root system. All of that takes energy, right? It's energy that's not yet coming from photosynthesis because it's underground. So that's where most of the energy store is spent to produce this new root system. But by the time it gets out of the soil, then conventional leaves immediately start to develop, and they take over the job of feeding the rest of the plant. And as long as the sunlight is shining, then it grows bigger and bigger. A little bit different situation in a typical monocot like corn. Instead of one thing coming out of the seed, there are two eruptions. A radical that develops into the root system, but it's a fibrous root system rather than a taproot system, remember. And then a structure that grows upward that develops into what's called a coleoptile, which is kind of like a tunnel itself. A coleoptile has to burrow through this soil, which can be very abrasive stuff, right? So it's a tough cylinder, basically, that takes the brunt of the damage as it grows up through the soil. But once it gets up there, then the fact that it's a cylinder means that's a safe tunnel through which the more tender structures can grow out of and become exposed to the air and grow into the leaves. All right, now 11. We've talked a bunch about flowers. Let's talk now about some fruits that the flowers become. And by the way, fruit is used as a culinary term, meaning things that we would eat. But there's a lot of fruit that we would not ever choose to eat at all. Botanically, what fruit means is simply the stuff that flowers turn into, whether we would want to eat them or not. So a fruit might be very little more than just the seeds, but fruits bear the seeds. Right? That's the job of the fruit, is to bear the seeds. Okay, but anyway, let's classify. There's different ways of classifying fruits. And one way is based on what happens to the carpels and how many carpels are involved. This explains the three of these four parts of the slide, the first three. First and simplest is the simple fruit. It's called a simple fruit. Pea plants are good examples of something that makes a simple fruit. What we, you know, one pod of peas is the fruit. And in that are so many seeds. The seeds are what we call the peas, right? Keep in mind, by the way, that those are siblings. Each one is an individual, already diploid, because it's already, remember, the fruit does not develop unless fertilization has occurred. So this is diploid. But they're like brothers and sisters. They're all genetically different from each other, even though they're in the same pod, because they all resulted from their own sperm and egg getting together. But anyway, a simple fruit is called simple if there is one carpel containing one ovary. Now, there's more than one ovule in that ovary, but a single ovary enlarges to make one fruit with however many fertilized seeds in there. All right? Aggregate fruit is next. The example shown here, as you see, is a raspberry. There's all kinds of aggregate fruits, though. This is similar to a simple fruit, except there are multiple ovaries involved. Okay, so multiple carpels, each with its own ovary. When you look at a raspberry, obviously you see the little lobes on it, right? It looks like it's a bunch of little spheres. Well, each of those little spheres, which is called a fruitlet, would be, if it were just by itself, a simple fruit. Because that resulted from one carpel being fertilized. But the flower had multiple carpels originally. And if they all get fertilized, then all of these fruitlets will develop at once, producing what we call an aggregate fruit. And to aggregate means to group together. That's a little bit more complex than simple, but even more complex is what we call a multiple fruit. The pineapple's an example here. There's a subtle difference here. An aggregate fruit is a single flower, starts with a single flower, but multiple carpels. Well, let me go back to the beginning. Simple fruit, one flower, one carpel develops into a fruit. Aggregate fruit, one flower, multiple carpels within that one flower, aggregate fruit. Okay? And the next step in complexity then is the multiple fruit. Here you have multiple flowers that, to our eyes, most people would say is one flower. Really, what we would call one flower is many tiny flowers that are grouped together so tightly that they look like one flower to us. And when you have such a situation, we call that an inflorescence. So a pineapple flower is really an inflorescence, which is multiple flowers, each with its own carpel. All right? So this is a multiple fruit is really, in a sense, the same thing as a simple fruit, just happening once for each of many flowers that are right next to each other. And therefore, each fruit from each flower grow together. And what we call one pineapple is really multiple fruits. These little sections that you see, each one of those came from its own flower with its own carpel, but they all grew together. Okay, you see the difference between aggregate and multiple? All right. Well, accessory fruit is something totally different. The apple here is an example. This is unlike the others because in most fruits, What develops in, you know, in most fruits that we would consider edible, which all of these are, the flesh of the fruit, the part that you actually eat, develops from the ovary. It's an enlarged ovary. And therefore contains the seeds that used to be ovules in that ovary. Right? Not so for an apple or any other accessory fruit. The part that contains the seeds and that came from the ovary in an apple is the part that most people don't eat at all. They just throw it away, the core. I don't eat apples very much, but when I do eat them, I eat the actual core and the seeds and everything. Only green apples. I don't like the red ones. But anyway, that kind of harder part that's interior, that the core is, if you try to eat the core, you notice a texture difference. That's really the only true fruit, because that came from the ovary. The fleshy part that people eat developed from the receptacle, which is the sepals and the structures that the green parts that originally before it budded, before the bud bloomed. Okay, so that's an accessory fruit. Let's go to a 12. A little bit ago we looked at modes of pollination. Pollination is required before you have fertilization, of course. You don't have seeds unless fertilization has already occurred, by definition of seeds. But once you have seeds, because fertilization is successful, then it's important for those seeds to be dispersed from the parent. You know, if a seed grows right beside its parent, it's not going to do as well as it would on its own, in its own open space with its own sunlight. So dispersal is important. And once again, wind can do this. Wind is not only a major pollinator, but it's also a major seed disperser. And once again, it's abiotic. Wind is not alive. Water, though, more so than a pollinator, water is a seed disperser for certain species, especially ones that produce seeds that are buoyant. They just float on the water and can go from an island to another island or whatever. By the way, the dandelion seeds are actually fruits. What we call a seed is more than just the seed. This is the fruit. So this is an example of a fruit that, botanically, this is a fruit, but this is not something most of us would choose to eat. And there's others that are really thorny that you wouldn't want to eat at all. But anyway, that's seed dispersal. There, of course, are biotic seed dispersers as well. Animals that do the job of carrying seeds around. The puncture vine here, that's a fruit. Botanically, you wouldn't choose to eat that. But it contains the seeds, like all fruits do. And the reason that this thing is not enticing to be eaten, which, by the way, plants are doing for the selfishly, right? They're not trying to feed us. They produce edibly enticing fruits so that some animals will come along and eat them and take the seeds with them. Well, this one doesn't have to be enticing as an edible fruit because it's going to do a good job of just sticking on the hide of an animal that happens by. Just like a jumping choya will stick to you very easily, so will this. And the animal will get some distance and finally eventually shake it off, and that disperses the seed. In a typical fruit, though, that is edible by animals, that's a good setup because it rewards the animals and they'll reliably come back in the future and get more fruit and disperse more seeds. But it's also nice because seeds are so tough that they elude digestion. The enzymes really don't work. The digestive enzymes of the animal don't work on the seed, and therefore they pass all the way through, survive the process, and in the end get delivered somewhere along with a nice batch of fertilizer for them to do well in. Ants are carrying, the ant here is carrying a seed that includes a so-called food body, which is kind of just a bonus, something that's going to make it worth dragging that seed around. Okay, now to 14. Obviously, we're looking at flowers here, and these happen to be incomplete flowers at the top. Remember, I said that not all flowers are complete. Incomplete flowers are missing something. Well, in this case, each of these two flowers, which are part of the same species, is missing not only one of the whorls, but is missing one of the fertile whorls. So if you don't have both male and female, you can't self-fertilize. Well, actually, this is what evolution is favoring. Self-fertilization is selected against, as though it's a disadvantage. And with the same, this is exactly why in most human societies it's taboo. Incest is taboo, right? And that's because there is a disadvantage to reproducing with an individual that is too closely genetically related to you. Inbreeding, in other words. Why is it disadvantageous? Whether you're an animal, a plant, whatever. Why do you want to, if you're a sexual species, reproduce with someone who's not highly related to you? Why? Yes, that's really the bottom line is genetic variation. More specifically, if you inbreed, then that makes it much more likely that two alleles that are deleterious or harmful could get together. Remember when we were doing that been there, done that exercise, you had the cystic fibrosis example? That's an example of a genetic disorder that is caused by a recessive allele. And therefore, since it's recessive, you can be just a carrier, right? If you're a heterozygote, you don't have cystic fibrosis because you have that one normal gene that will keep you normal. But if you mate with someone who is also a carrier, a heterozygote, then there's a 1 in 4 chance that your mutant allele is going to get together with your mate's mutant allele and create an offspring that actually has cystic fibrosis. So, if you are inbreeding, chances are that their genes are just like yours, and therefore it maximizes the chance of bad genes getting together. So that's the reason why inbreeding is disfavored evolutionarily, and plants have evolved ways to minimize the chances of self-fertilization. And one evolutionary way that they've done this is by producing flowers that lack either the male or the female parts. They're on separate flowers on separate plants, and they therefore require outbreeding rather than inbreeding. Dioecious, by the way, means two houses. So there's a male house and a female house is why they have this name. But in terms of the flowers, some of the flowers are called staminate flowers. That just means that those are flowers that produce stamens, but not carpels. So they're male. And carpellate flowers produce carpels, but not stamens. And so there's really no chance of inbreeding in that case, right? On the bottom, we have a complete flower, though. And in a complete flower, there's always at least a chance of self-fertilization. But it's still minimized just for a different reason. Here you have still two types of flowers, but both of them have both male and female parts. The thrum flower, notice when you look at the interior of it, has long stamens and short carpels. The pin flower, on the other hand, has long carpels and short stamens. Now imagine that you're a bee or some other insect going in there. You've already been to this type of flower, you've been to the species, so you know where the nectar is. You enter and do the same thing every time, basically. You move your body the same way to get rewarded. So if you come into a thrum flower, that's, remember, it's the pollen is on the male parts, the stamens. So if you come into a thrum flower, this is going to deliver, you're going to get dusted the back part of your body, because you'd be upside down here. The back part of your body is going to get dusted with pollen. Now you go to a pin flower that looks the same to you, and you know has the nectar in it. You go in the same way. Well, that pollen that you picked up in this part of your body is now going to be matched up perfectly with these long carpels that are in the other type of flower. Whereas they won't, you know, you can move around in here and you're still not going to deliver pollen to the short carpels. See what I'm saying? So it avoids self-fertilization. That's all been set. Everything we've talked about up to now is sexual reproduction. But plants can reproduce sexually or asexually, or at least certain species can do either. Asexual reproduction, whether it's in a plant or any other kind of asexual reproducer, involves only one parent, of course, right? So there is no breeding, really. There is simply creating exact genetic duplicates of yourself. That's what asexual reproduction accomplishes. Why, by the way, would you ever want that to be? What's the advantage of asexual reproduction? Well, what is the big deal about sex? What does sex do?
Cloning the DNA.
Right. It makes new versions of individuals, right? Because they're not genetically identical to either parent. It's a brand new mixture of genes. So it amplifies genetic variability. Asexual reproduction does not. It keeps the genes how they are in the original parent. When would that be advantageous? It would be advantageous if you, as the asexual reproducer, are really well fit to your surroundings. You're fit because of your genes, right? So if it's really working well, you wouldn't want to mix it up, right? You want to just make copies of yourself. What's the problem with that, though? What does that assume?
The environment won't change.
Right. It assumes that the environment's going to stay the same. And it doesn't. Sometimes it drastically changes quickly, but it always at least gradually changes. And that's why evolution still has to change the genes of asexual reproducers. But a sexual reproducing species makes all kinds of random offspring, some of which won't be as well fit as the parent, but some might be even better fit to a changing environment. That's why sex is, in the long run, advantageous. But these aspen trees that we see here, you might look at this from overhead in this picture and say, well, this is a bunch of different trees. They're all genetically distinct individuals because trees are sexual species. It's not true, though. Actually, almost all of these are clones, or really what we call a clone is a set of organisms that are all identical. So this is a huge clone of that started by one original tree. They're still capable of sexual reproduction, but when they can do both, it sometimes is favorable to do asexual. Well, speaking of cloning, we can also artificially clone plants. Slide 16 shows this happening. Plants are, compared to animals, much easier to clone, and that's because of something I was telling you about before. Plants always have these juvenile parts in them. They have stem cells throughout their lifetime. I don't think I've talked about stem cells already, have I? What makes a stem cell a stem cell? What is it that defines a stem cell? Whether it's in an animal or a plant or whatever. You've heard of stem cells, right? I'm sure you've heard them in the news. Stem cells are valuable because they have the ability, when they divide into two new cells, to produce multiple different kinds of cells. If you think about a typical cell in your body, like a skin cell, it is already defined as a skin cell. It reproduces itself a lot because you have to continually make new skin cells. But when a skin cell produces two new skin cells by mitosis and cytokinesis, those have to be skin cells. That's all they can be. A stem cell, on the other hand, is what we start out as originally. We start out as a zygote, we turn into an embryo, and that embryo, however many cells it is made up of what we call embryonic stem cells. Because the cells that they give rise to, develop into all different parts of the body. This is called totipotence, the ability of a stem cell to turn into any kind of cell in that individual is totipotence. That's the noun, or we say that the stem cell is totipotent with a T. Those are the strongest kind of stem cells that can become anything. And in us, those are only in our bodies as when we're an embryo. And this is why embryonic stem cells were so valuable to researchers when this was a controversy. Well, it's been a while now, 20 years ago. Anyway, we still have stem cells in us even in adulthood, but we don't have totipotent stem cells that can become anything. For instance, in the marrow of our body, we have stem cells that we say are pluripotent. Pluripotent means they can turn into more than one or plural type of cells, just not all of the kinds of cells. Okay. The pluripotent stem cells that we have in our marrow are stem cells because when they split, they can make any of the six kinds of blood cells, red blood cells, or any of the five kinds of white cells. Okay, so that's stem cells. But they can't produce kidney cells or anything else. It has to just be a blood cell. Well, these meristems that are in plants that I called permanently juvenile structures, even when they're adults, they have these juvenile structures. Those have totipotent stem cells in them. And that makes them really easy to clone. All you need to do is take a cell out of one of those from an adult, give it the right conditions and the right nutrients, and it will start splitting by mitosis and cytokinesis into a multicellular clump that doesn't look much like a plant yet. It's called a callus. But eventually, it will figure out where down is and start sprouting and start developing a root system that are different kinds of cells compared to the shoot system that develops, and eventually it will become something that is a viable adult. All right, so that's cloning. We can do this pretty easily with plants compared to animals. Slide 17, this has nothing to do with cloning, but with biotechnology, really. Now, there's two uses of the word biotechnology. Strictly speaking, or I shouldn't say strictly, generally speaking, biotechnology refers to using an organism for some humanly beneficial product. That's all biotechnology is. And by that general definition, biotechnology has been practiced for thousands of years. Agriculture, by that definition, is biotechnology. Because by allowing certain plants to live, the ones that have the traits that we like, and allowing others not to live by natural selection, which agriculture is, I'm sorry, not natural selection, artificial selection, you know, we're interfering with their genes. That's just the old-fashioned way, though, right? Where they're still getting their genes together naturally, in a sense. We're just saying who's allowed to survive. But that's still, that's genetic modification. Agriculture is genetic modification the old-fashioned way, and we've been doing that for thousands of years, giving rise to something like corn, which is an example of a grass This is another grass that still exists, but is probably pretty close to what the ancestor to both of them looked like originally that we started working with. And through many generations and picking and choosing which ones are allowed to survive and which ones don't, we eventually came to modern corn, which would have no hope at all of surviving in nature anymore. Its seeds don't get released, all kinds of things go wrong, unless humans are here to make it happen. So this is, in a sense, an artificial organism, because it's been produced by genetic modification via agriculture. But biotechnology nowadays is defined in a more strict sense, meaning directly interfering. Well, I shouldn't say biotechnology, but specifically a part of biotechnology is genetic modification. I just told you that agriculture is genetic modification, but that's the old school way. Nowadays, genetic modification refers to actually humans getting in there and directly modifying genes rather than just deciding who lives and who dies. And so that gives rise to what we call genetically modified organisms, or GM organisms, GMOs. This can be done with any organism, but we do it much more with plants than anything else, at least for now. And there are, this is a currently controversial subject because there's pros and cons. But this picture in 18, showing an individual carrying cassava, represents one of the potential benefits of genetic modification. By the way, before I get to that, let me say that there are two major kinds of molecular genetic modification. There is transgenesis. Did I go through these already? I keep thinking I've told you this before. Maybe I didn't. Transgenesis, and what's the opposite of trans? In chemistry? Cis. Cisgenesis. That's why you have people that are transgender and people that are cisgender. Same use of those prefixes. Anyway, it's really the same process that happens in both of these processes, but we give them different names. Transgenesis is taking a gene from some organism. It's just a normal gene in that organism, but then putting it into some organism that's not very highly related at all to the organism that had that gene originally. For instance, if you take have you seen these glowing mice? You take a gene out of a jellyfish that naturally glows, put it into a mouse embryo, it'll grow into a full mouse, but if you successfully get that gene into one cell in that embryo, it's going to be repeated, it's going to be copied naturally by the growing embryo, and therefore the whole mouse's body will have that gene that allows it to glow. And so under ultraviolet light, they literally glow green. Not natural from the mouse's point of view, but the gene is operating naturally. It's doing the same thing that it does in the original organism, just in a different organism. But it's transgenesis because the donor and the recipient are very highly unrelated. Cisgenesis is exactly the same thing. It's just you're taking it from a donor and giving it, you're taking it from a donor and putting it into a recipient that's pretty much similar, like one type of plant into another type of the same kind of plant. All right? Same process, though. So, one of the reasons that we use genetic modification of plants is in hopes of reducing the amount of massive amounts of chemicals we have to spill on them as pesticides. If you can eliminate those pesticides, which are harmful for us to eat, and allow them to be impervious to pests just genetically, then that's one reason. And there's a lot of genetic modification that's done nowadays for that reason. But another reason is to improve the quality of the food in some way. In the case of these cassavas, there's millions of people in the world, different places, that have cassava as almost their only food. And it's a good nourishment source, but it's not complete. It doesn't contain everything that humans require. If that's all you eat, you're going to be deficient in some vitamins and other things. So the cassavas have been genetically modified to add those things that aren't there naturally so that the humans survive, that eat them almost exclusively. And also, cassava has naturally a poison in it that at low levels isn't a big deal, but if that's all you eat, it can become a big deal. And so the genetically modified versions don't have nearly as high levels of the toxin. So that's just one reason, and that's what we'll end the chapter on.